Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Blue Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson, narrated by Richard Ferrone. This work is copyrighted 1996 by Kim Stanley Robinson. This recording is copyrighted 2001 by Recorded Books. In this, the final book of the Mars trilogy, Earth is in peril. A great flood threatens an already overpopulated and polluted planet, and Mars, its last hope, may find itself facing a population explosion or an interplanetary war. And now? Blue Mars.
Part 1. Peacock Mountain. Mars is free now. We're on our own. No one tells us what to do. Anne stood at the front of the train as she said this. But it's so easy to backslide into old patterns of behavior. Break one hierarchy and another springs up to take its place. We will have to be on guard for that, because there will always be people trying to make another Earth. The Areophany will have to be ceaseless, an eternal struggle. We will have to think harder than ever before what it means to be Martian. Her listeners sat slumped in chairs looking out the windows at the terrain flowing by. They were tired, their eyes were scoured. Red-eyed reds. In the harsh dawn light, everything looked new, the windswept land outside bare except for a khaki scree of lichen and scrub. They had kicked all earthly power off Mars. It had been a long campaign, capped by months of furious action following the great flood on Terra, and they were tired. We came from Earth to Mars, and in that passage there was a certain purification. Things were easier to see. There was a freedom of action that we had not had before. A chance to express the best part of ourselves. So we acted. We are making a better way to live. This was the myth. They had all grown up with it. Now, as Anne told it to them again, the young Martians stared through her. They had engineered the revolution. They had fought all over Mars and pushed the Terran police into Burrows. Then they had drowned Burrows and chased the Terrans up to Sheffield on Pavonis Mons. They still had to force the enemy out of Sheffield, up the space cable and back to Terra. There was work still to be done. But in the successful evacuation of Burrows, they had won a great victory, and some of the blank faces staring at Anne or out the window seemed to want a break, a moment for triumph. They were all exhausted. "Hiroko will help us," a young man said, breaking the silence of the train's levitation over the land. Anne shook her head. "Hiroko is a green," she said. "The original green." "Hiroko invented the Areophany," the young native countered. "That's her first concern. Mars. She will help us, I know. I met her. She told me." "Except she's dead," someone else said. Another silence. The world flowed under them. Finally, a tall young woman stood up and walked down the aisle and gave Anne a hug. The spell was broken. Words were abandoned. They got to their feet and clustered in the open space at the front of the train around Anne and hugged her, or shook her hand, or simply touched her. Anne Claiborne, the one who had taught them to love Mars for itself, who had led them in the struggle for its independence from Earth. And though her bloodshot eyes were still fixed, gazing through them at the rocky, battered expanse of the Terrina Massif, she was smiling. She hugged them back, She shook their hands. She reached up to touch their faces. "It will be all right," she said. "We will make Mars free." And they said yes and congratulated each other. "On to Sheffield," they said. "Finish the job. Mars will show us how." "Except she's not dead," the young man objected. "I saw her last month in Arcadia. She'll show up again. She'll show up somewhere." At a certain moment before dawn, the sky always glowed the same bands of pink as in the beginning, pale and clear in the east, rich and starry in the west. Anne watched for this moment as her companions drove them west toward a mass of black land rearing into the sky, the Tharsis Bulge, punctuated by the broad cone of Pavonis Mons. As they rolled uphill from Noctis Labyrinthus, they rose above most of the new atmosphere. The air pressure at the foot of Pavonis was only 180 millibars, and then as they drove up the eastern flank of the Great Shield Volcano, it dropped under 100 millibars and continued to fall. Slowly they ascended above all visible foliage, crunching over dirty patches of wind-carved snow. Then they ascended above even the snow until there was nothing but rock and the ceaseless, thin, cold winds of the jet stream. The bare land looked just as it had in the pre-human years, as if they were driving back up into the past. It wasn't so. But something fundamental in Anne Claiborne warmed at the sight of this ferric world, stone on rock in the perpetual wind, and as the red cars rolled up the mountain, all their occupants grew as rapt as Anne, the cabins falling silent as the sun cracked the distant horizon behind them. Then the slope they ascended grew less steep, in a perfect sine curve, until they were on the flat land of the Round Summit Plateau. Here they saw tent towns ringing the edge of the giant caldera, clustered in particular around the foot of the space elevator, some 30 kilometers to the south of them. They stopped their cars. The silence in the cabins had shifted from reverent to grim. Anne stood at one upper cabin window, looking south toward Sheffield, that child of the space elevator. Built because of the elevator, smashed flat when the elevator fell, built again with the elevator's replacement. This was the city she had come to destroy as thoroughly as Rome had Carthage, for she meant to bring down the replacement cable, too, just as they had the first one in 2061. When they did that, much of Sheffield would again be flattened. What remained would be located uselessly on the peak of a high volcano above most of the atmosphere. As time passed, the surviving structures would be abandoned and dismantled for salvage, leaving only the tent foundations and perhaps a weather station and, eventually, the long sunny silence of a mountain summit. The salt was already in the ground. A cheerful Tharsis Red named Erishka joined them in a small rover and led them through the maze of warehouses and small tents surrounding the intersection of the equatorial piste with the one circling the rim. As they followed her, she described for them the local situation. Most of Sheffield and the rest of the Pavonis Rim settlements were already in the hands of the Martian revolutionaries. But the space elevator and the neighborhood surrounding its base complex were not, and there lay the difficulty. The revolutionary forces on Pavonis were mostly poorly equipped militias, and they didn't necessarily share the same agenda. That they had succeeded as far as they had was due to many factors. Surprise, the control of Martian space, several strategic victories, the support of the great majority of the Martian population, the unwillingness of the United Nations Transitional Authority to fire on civilians, even when they were making mass demonstrations in the streets. As a result, the UNTA security forces had retreated from all over Mars to regroup in Sheffield, and now most of them were in elevator cars going up to Clark, the ballast asteroid and space station at the top of the elevator. The rest were jammed into the neighborhood surrounding the elevator's massive base complex called the Socket. This district consisted of elevator support facilities, industrial warehouses, and the hostels, dormitories, and restaurants needed to house and feed the port's workforce. "Those are coming in useful now," Arishka said. "Because even so, they're squeezed in like trash in a compactor, and if there hadn't been food and shelter, they would probably have tried a breakout. As it is, things are still tense, but at least they can live." It somewhat resembled the situation just resolved in Burrows, Anne thought, which had turned out fine. It only took someone willing to act, and the thing would be done. UNTA evacuated to Earth, the cable brought down, Mars's link to Earth truly broken, and any attempt to erect a new cable could be balked sometime in the 10 years of orbital construction that it took to build one. So Arishka led them through the jumble that was East Pavonis, and their little caravan came to the rim of the caldera where they parked their rovers. To the south on the western edge of Sheffield they could just make out the elevator cable, a line that was barely visible, and then only for a few kilometers out of its 24,000. Nearly invisible, in fact, and yet its existence dominated every move they made, every discussion, every thought they had, almost, speared and strung out on that black thread connecting them to Earth. When they were settled in their camp, Anne called her son Peter on the wrist. He was one of the leaders of the revolution on Tharsis, and had directed the campaign against UNTA that had left its forces contained in the Socket and its immediate neighborhood. A qualified victory at best, but it made Peter one of the heroes of the previous month. Now he answered the call, and his face appeared on her wrist. He looked quite like her, which she found disconcerting. He was absorbed, she saw, concentrating on something other than her call. "Any news?" she asked. "No. We appear to be at something of an impasse. We're allowing all of them caught outside free passage into the elevator district, so they've got control of the train station and the South Rim airport and the subway lines from those to the Socket. Did the planes that evacuated them from Burrows come here?" "Yes, apparently most of them are leaving for Earth. It's very crowded in there." "Are they going back to Earth or into Mars orbit?" "Back to Earth. I don't think they trust orbit anymore." He smiled at that. He had done a lot in space, aiding Sax's efforts and so on. Her son, the spaceman, the Green. For many years they had scarcely spoken to each other. Anne said, "So what are you going to do now?" "I don't know. I don't see that we can take the elevator or the Socket either. It just wouldn't work. Even if it did, they could always bring the elevator down." "So?" "Well," he looked suddenly concerned, "I don't think that would be a good thing. Do you?" "I think it should come down." Now he looked annoyed. "Better stay out of the fall line, then." "I will." "I don't want anyone bringing it down without a full discussion," he told her sharply. "This is important. It should be a decision made by the whole Martian community. I think we need the elevator myself."
"Except we have no way to take possession of it."
"That remains to be seen. Meanwhile, it's not something for you to take into your own hands. I heard what happened in Burrows, but it's different here, you understand? We decide strategy together. It needs to be discussed." "It's a group that's very good at that," Anne said bitterly. Everything was always thoroughly discussed, and then always she lost. It was past time for that. Someone had to act. But again, Peter looked as if he were being taken from his real work. He thought he would be making the decisions about the elevator. She could see that.
part of a more general feeling of ownership of the planet, no doubt, the birthright of the Nisei, displacing the first 100 and all the rest of the Issei. If John had lived, that wouldn't have been easy, but the king was dead. Long live the king, her son, king of the Nisei, the first true Martians. But king or not, there was a Red Army now converging on Pavonis Mons. They were the strongest military operation left on the planet, and they intended to complete the work begun when Earth had been hit by its great flood. They didn't believe in consensus or compromise, and for them, knocking down the cable was killing two birds with one stone. It would destroy the last police stronghold, and it would also sever easy contact between Earth and Mars, a primary Red goal. No, knocking down the cable was the obvious thing to do. But Peter didn't seem to know this. Or perhaps he didn't care. Anne tried to tell him, but he just nodded, muttering, yeah. So arrogant, like all the Greens. So blithe and stupid with all their prevaricating, their dealing with Earth, as if you could ever get anything from such a leviathan. No. It was going to take direct action, as in the drowning of Burroughs, as in all the acts of sabotage that had set the stage for the revolution. Without those, the revolution wouldn't even have begun, or if it had, it would have been crushed immediately, as in 2061. Yeah, we'd better call a meeting then, Peter said, looking as annoyed at her as she felt at him. Yeah, Anne said heavily. Meetings. But they had their uses. People could assume they meant something while the real work went on elsewhere. I'll try to set one up, Peter said. She had gotten his attention at last, she saw. But there was an unpleasant look on his face, as if he had been threatened. Before things get out of hand. Things are already out of hand, she told him, and cut the connection. She checked the news on the various channels, Mangalavid, the Reds' private nets, the Terran summaries. Though Pavonis and the elevator were now the focus of everyone on Mars, the physical convergence on the volcano was only partial. It appeared to her that there were more Red guerrilla units on Pavonis than the Green units of Free Mars and their allies, but it was hard to be sure. Kasei and the most radical wing of the Reds, called the Kakazi, Firewind, had recently occupied the north rim of Pavonis, taking over the train station and tent at last flow. The Reds Anne had traveled with, most of them from the old Red mainstream, discussed moving around the rim and joining the Kakazi, but decided in the end to stay in East Pavonis. Anne observed this discussion silently, but was glad at the result, as she wanted to keep her distance from Kasei and Dao and their crowd. She was pleased to stay in East Pavonis. Many Free Mars troops were staying there as well, moving out of their cars into the abandoned warehouses. East Pavonis was becoming a major concentration of revolutionary groups of all kinds, and a couple days after her arrival, Anne went in and walked over compacted regolith to one of the biggest warehouses in the tent to take part in a general strategy session. The meeting went about as she expected. Nadia was at the center of the discussion, and it was useless talking to Nadia now. Anne just sat on a chair against the back wall, watching the rest of them circle the situation. They didn't want to say what Peter had already admitted to her in private. There was no way to get Unta off the space elevator. Before they conceded that, they were going to try to talk the problem out of existence. Late in the meeting, Sax Russell came over to sit by her side. A space elevator, he said. It could be used. Anne was not the least bit comfortable talking to Sax. She knew that he had suffered brain damage at the hands of UNTA security and had taken a treatment that had changed his personality. But somehow this hadn't helped at all. It only made things very strange in that sometimes he seemed to her to be the same old Sax, as familiar as a much-hated brother, while at other times he did indeed seem like a completely different person inhabiting Sax's body. These two contrary impressions oscillated rapidly, even sometimes coexisted. Just before joining her, as he had talked with Nadia and Art, he had looked like a stranger, a dapper old man with a piercing glare, talking in Sax's voice and Sax's old style. Now, as he sat next to her, she could see that the changes to his face were utterly superficial. But though he looked familiar, the stranger was now inside him. For here was a man who halted and jerked as he delved painfully after what he was trying to say, and then, as often as not, came out with something scarcely coherent.
The elevator is a device for raising up a tool.
Not if we don't control it, Anne said to him carefully, as if instructing a child.
Control,
Sax said, thinking over the concept as if it were entirely new to him.
Influence? If the elevator can be brought down by anyone who really wants to, then...
He trailed away, lost in his thoughts. Then what? Anne prompted.
Then it's controlled by all. Consensual existence, it's obvious.
It was as if he were translating from a foreign language. This was not Sax. Anne could only shake her head and try gently to explain. The elevator was the conduit for the Metanationals to reach Mars, she told him. It was in the possession of the Metanats now, and the revolutionaries had no means to kick their police forces off of it. Clearly the thing to do in such a situation was to bring it down. Warn people, give them a schedule, and then do it. Loss of life would be minimal, and what there was would be pretty much the fault of anyone so stupid as to stay on the cable or the equator. Unfortunately, Nadia heard this from the middle of the room, and she shook her head so violently that her cropped gray locks flew out like a clown's ruff. She was still very angry with Anne over Burroughs, for no good reason at all, and so Anne glared at her as she walked over to them and said curtly, "We need the elevator. It's our conduit to Terra just as much as it's their conduit to Mars."
"But we don't need a conduit to Terra," Anne said. "It's not a physical relationship for us, don't you see? I'm not saying we don't need to have an influence on Terra. I'm not an isolationist like Cassay or Coyote. I agree we need to try to work on them, but it's not a physical thing, don't you see? It's a matter of ideas, of talk, and perhaps a few emissaries. It's an information exchange. At least it is when it's going right. It's when it gets into a physical thing, a resource exchange, or mass emigration or police control, that's when the elevator becomes useful, even necessary. So if we took it down, we would be saying, we will deal with you on our terms, and not yours." It was so obvious, but Nadia shook her head at what Anne couldn't imagine. Sax cleared his throat, and in his old periodic table style said,
"If we can bring it down, then in effect it is as if it already were down,"
blinking and everything. Like a ghost suddenly there at her side, the voice of the terraforming, the enemy she had lost to time and time again, Saxifrage Russell, his own self, same as ever. And all she could do was make the same arguments she always had, the losing arguments, feeling the word's inadequacy right in her mouth. Still, she tried. "People act on what's there, Sax. The Metanat directors and the UN and the governments will look up and see what's there and act accordingly. If the cable's gone, they just don't have the resources or the time to mess with us right now. If the cable's here, then they'll want us. They'll think, well, we could do it. And there'll be people screaming to try.
They can always come. The cable is only a fuel saver.
A fuel saver which makes mass transfers possible.
But now Sax was distracted and turning back into a stranger. No one would pay attention to her for long enough. Nadia was going on about control of orbit and safe conduct passes and the like. The strange Sax interrupted Nadia, having never heard her, and said,
"We've promised to help them out."
"By sending them more metals?" Anne said. "Do they really need those?"
"We could take people. It might help."
Anne shook her head. "We could never take enough." He frowned. Nadia saw they weren't listening to her, returned to the table. Sax and Anne fell into silence. Always they argued. Neither conceded anything, no compromises were made, nothing was ever accomplished. They argued using the same words to mean different things, and scarcely even spoke to one another. Once it had been different very long ago, when they had argued in the same language and understood each other, but that had been so long ago she couldn't even remember when exactly it was. In Antarctica? Somewhere. But not on Mars. "You know," Sax said in a conversational tone, again very un-Sax-like, but in a different way, "it wasn't the Red Militia that caused the Transitional Authority to evacuate Burrows and the rest of the planet. If guerrillas had been the only factor, then the Terrans would have gone after us, and they might well have succeeded. But those mass demonstrations in the tents made it clear that almost everyone on the planet was against them. That's what governments fear the most. Mass protests in the cities. Hundreds of thousands of people going into the streets to reject the current system. That's what Nergal means when he says political power comes out of the look in people's eye, and not out of the end of a gun."
"And so," Anne said. Sax gestured at the people in the warehouse.
"They're all greens." The others continued debating. Sax watched her like a bird. Anne got up and walked out of the meeting into the strangely unbusy streets of East Pavonis. Here and there, militia bands held posts on street corners, keeping an eye to the south, toward Sheffield and the cable terminal. Happy, hopeful, serious young natives. There on one corner, a group was in an animated discussion, and as Anne passed them, a young woman, her face utterly intent, flushed with passionate conviction, cried out, "You can't just do what you want!" Anne walked on. As she walked, she felt more and more uneasy, without knowing why. This is how people change. In little quantum jumps when struck by outer events. No intention, no plan. Someone says, "the look in people's eye," and the phrase is suddenly conjoined with an image. A face glowing with passionate conviction. Another phrase. "You can't just do what you want." And so it occurred to her, the look on that young woman's face, that it was not just the cable's fate they were deciding, not just should the cable come down, but how do we decide things? That was the critical post-revolutionary question, perhaps more important than any single issue being debated, even the fate of the cable. Up until now, most people in the underground had operated by a working method which said, "if we don't agree with you, we will fight you." That attitude was what had gotten people into the underground in the first place, Anne included. And once used to that method, it was hard to get away from it. After all, they had just proved that it worked. And so there was the inclination to continue to use it. She felt that herself. But political power...
Say it did come out of the look in people's eye. You could fight forever, but if people weren't behind you... Anne continued to think about that as she drove down into Sheffield, having decided to skip the farce of the afternoon strategy session in East Pavonis. She wanted to have a look at the seat of the action. It was curious how little seemed to have changed in the day-to-day life of Sheffield. People still went to work, ate in restaurants, talked on the grass of the parks, gathered in the public places in this most crowded of tent towns. The shops and restaurants were jammed. Most businesses in Sheffield had belonged to the Metanats, and now people read on their screens long arguments over what to do, what the employees' new relationship to their old owners should be, where they should buy their raw materials, where they should sell, whose regulations they ought to obey, whose taxes they ought to pay. All very confusing, as the screen debates and the nightly news vids and the wrist nets indicated. The plaza devoted to the food market, however, looked as it always had. Most food was grown and distributed by co-ops, ag networks were in place, the greenhouses on Pavonis were still producing, and so in the market things ran as usual, goods paid for with unta dollars or with credit. Except once or twice Anne saw sellers in their aprons shouting red-faced at customers, who shouted right back, arguing over some point of government policy. As Anne passed by one of these arguments, which were no different than those going on among the leaders in East Pavonis, the disputants all stopped and stared at her. She had been recognized. The vegetable seller said loudly, "If you Reds would lay off, they would just go away." "Ah, come on," someone retorted. "It isn't her doing it." So true, Anne thought as she walked on. A crowd stood waiting for a tram to come. The transport systems were still running, ready for autonomy. The tent itself was functioning, which wasn't something to be taken for granted, though clearly most people did. But every tent's operators had their task obvious before them. They mined their raw materials themselves, mostly out of the air. Their solar collectors and nuclear reactors were all the power they needed. So the tents were physically fragile, but if left alone, they could very well become politically autonomous. There was no reason for them to be owned, no justification for it. So the necessities were served. Daily life plodded on, barely perturbed by revolution. Or so it seemed at first glance. But there in the streets also were armed groups, young natives in threes and fours and fives, standing on street corners. Revolutionary militias around their missile launchers and remote sensing dishes. Green or red, it didn't matter, though they were almost certainly greens. People eyed them as they walked by, or stopped to chat and find out what they were doing. "Keeping an eye on the socket," the armed native said. Though Anne could see that they were functioning as police as well. Part of the scene, accepted, supported. People grinned as they chatted. These were their police. They were fellow Martians, here to protect them, to guard Sheffield for them. People wanted them there, that was clear. If they hadn't, then every approaching questioner would have been a threat, every glance of resentment an attack, which eventually would have forced the militias from the street corners into some safer place. People's faces staring in concert. This ran the world. So Anne brooded over the next few days, and even more so after she took a rim train in the direction opposite to Sheffield, counterclockwise to the north arc of the rim. There, Cassay and Dow and the Kakazi were occupying apartments in the little tent at Last Flow. Apparently, they had forcibly evicted some non-combatant residents, who naturally had trained down to Sheffield in fury, demanding to be reinstated in their homes, and reporting to Peter and the rest of the Green leaders that the Reds had set up truck-drawn rocket launchers on the North Rim, with the rockets aimed at the elevator and Sheffield more generally. So Anne walked out into Lastflow's little station in a bad mood, angry at the Kakazi's arrogance, as stupid in its way as the Greens. They had done well in the Burrows campaign, seizing the dike very visibly to give everyone a warning, then taking it on themselves to breach the dike after all the other revolutionary factions had gathered on the heights to the south, ready to rescue the city's civilian population while the Medinat security were forced to retreat. The Kakazi had seen what had been needed, and they had done it without getting bogged down in debate. Without their decisiveness, everyone would still be gathered around Burrows, and the Medinats no doubt organizing a Terran expeditionary force to relieve it. It had been a perfectly delivered coup. Now it seemed that success had gone to their head. Lastflow had been named after the depression it occupied, a fan-shaped lava flow extending more than 100 kilometers down the northeast flank of the mountain. It was the only blemish in what was otherwise a flawlessly circular summit cone and caldera, and clearly it had come very late in the volcano's history of eruptions. Standing down in the depression, one's view of the rest of the summit was cut off. It was like being in a shallow hanging valley with little visible in any direction, until one walked out to the drop-off at Rim's edge and saw the huge cylinder of the caldera coring the planet, and on the far rim the skyline of Sheffield, looking like a tiny Manhattan over 40 kilometers away. The curtailed view perhaps explained why the depression had been one of the last parts of the rim to be developed, but now it was filled by a fair-sized tent, 6 kilometers in diameter and 100 meters high, heavily reinforced as all tents up here had to be. The settlement had been home mostly to commuter laborers in the rim's many industries. Now the rimfront district had been taken over by the Kakazi, and just outside the tent stood a fleet of large rovers, no doubt the ones that had caused the rumors about rocket launchers. As Anne was led to the restaurant that Kasey had made his headquarters, she was assured by her guides that this was indeed the case. The rovers did haul rocket launchers, which were ready to flatten Nunta's last refuge on Mars. Her guides were obviously happy about this, and happy also to be able to tell her about it, happy to meet her and guide her around. A varied bunch, mostly natives with some Terran newcomers and old-timers of all ethnic backgrounds. Among them were a few faces Anne recognized. Etsu Okokora, Alkan, Yusuf. A lot of young natives unknown to her stopped them at the restaurant door to shake her hand, grinning enthusiastically. The Kakazi. They were, she had to admit to herself, the wing of the Reds for which she felt the least sympathy. Angry ex-Terrans or idealistic young natives from the tents, their stone eye-teeth dark in their smiles, their eyes glittering as they got this chance to meet her, as they spoke of Kami. The need for purity, the intrinsic value of rock, the rights of the planet, and so on. In short, fanatics. She shook their hands and nodded, trying not to let her discomfort show. Inside the restaurant, Kasey and Dao were sitting by a window drinking dark beer. Everything in the room stopped on Anne's entrance, and it took a while for people to be introduced, for Kasey and Dao to welcome her with hugs, for meals and conversations to resume. They got her something to eat from the kitchen. The restaurant workers came out to meet her. They were Kakazi as well. Anne waited until they were gone and people had gone back to their tables, feeling impatient and awkward. These were her spiritual children, the media always were saying. She was the original Red. But in truth, they made her uncomfortable. Kasey, in excellent spirits, as he had been ever since the revolution began, said, "We're going to bring down the cable in about a week." "Oh, you are," Anne said. "Why wait so long?" Dao missed her sarcasm. "It's a matter of warning people so they have time to get off the equator." Though normally a sour man, today he was as cheery as Kasey. "And off the cable, too?" "If they feel like it. But even if they evacuate it and give it to us, it's still coming down."
How? Are those really rocket launchers out there?
Yes. But those are there in case they come down and try to retake Sheffield. As for bringing down the cable, breaking it here at the base isn't the way to do it.
The control rockets might be able to adjust to disruptions at the bottom, Cassay explained. Hard to say what would happen, really. But a break just above the aerosynchronous point would decrease damage to the equator and keep New Clark from flying off as fast as the first one did. We want to minimize the drama of this, you know, avoid any martyrs we can. Just the demolition of a building, you know? Like a building past its usefulness.
Yes, Anne said, relieved at this sign of good sense. But it was curious how hearing her idea expressed as someone else's plan disturbed her. She located the main source of her concern. What about the others, the Greens? What if they object?
They won't, Dow said. They are, Anne said sharply.
Dow shook his head.
I've been talking to Jackie. It may be that some of the Greens are truly opposed to it, but her group is just saying that for public consumption, so that they look moderate to the Terrans and can blame the dangerous stuff on radicals out of their control.
On us, Anne said. They both nodded.
Just like with Burroughs, Cassay said with a smile.
Anne considered it. No doubt it was true.
But some of them are genuinely opposed. I've been arguing with them about it, and it's no publicity stunt.
Uh-huh, Cassay said slowly. Both he and Dow watched her.
So you'll do it anyway, she said at last.
They continued to watch her. She saw all of a sudden that they would no more do what she told them to do than would boys ordered about by a senile grandmother. They were humoring her, figuring out how they could best put her to use.
We have to, Cassay said. It's in the best interest of Mars, not just for Reds, but all of us. We need some distance between us and Terra, and the gravity well re-establishes that distance. Without it, we'll be sucked down into the maelstrom.
It was Anne's argument. It was just what she had been saying in the meetings in East Pavonis.
But what if they try to stop you?
I don't think they can, Cassay said.
But if they try? The two men glanced at each other. Dow shrugged.
So, Anne thought, watching them, they were willing to start a civil war.
This ends side one of cassette one. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.